Whenever a crisis occurs, especially one with tragic overtones, such as that with Sandy Hook Elementary in 2012 with the shooting of 20 children, all manner of people come forward to offer opinion, speculation, and conjecture on agendas and theories that only have a tenuous connection to the truth. While a free society welcomes these perspectives, a rigorous society meets these with an equal amount of skepticism. In the case of Sandy Hook, stories about gun control, school safety, homeschooling, and mental health abounded. Little focus, however, was paid to the extent to which the shooter, Adam Lanza, was on massive amounts of prescription drugs. Today, we are joined by radio host Deanna Spingola, who spent 3 years researching her book, Screening Sandy Hook, to uncover to what extent the pharmaceutical industry has come to dominate American society, the government, and in many ways, large segments of the media.
I've earned everything I've got.
Military industrial complex.
A new world order.
But we are here to destroy the control over the industry of other people.
I did not trade arms for hockey.
It's been 9 years.
Hello and welcome to the Myth of the 20th Century. Today we are joined by a very special guest, Deanna Spingola, to talk about the Sandy Hook event that happened in 2012. Thank you for coming on, Deanna. We were on your show about a month ago, and we had a great time. You're the host of a weekly radio show, and we're going to put a link to that. She's been doing this for many years. She's extremely well-researched scholar, and without further ado, let me introduce Deanna to the show. Please say hello.
Hi, how are you? Thank you for having me on.
Yeah, and you wrote a book about this, I should mention, and so that's why we wanted to talk about this topic. I'm also joined by my co-host, Nick.
Hi, Nick.
Hello. How are you, Deanna? I wanted to, though it's not the subject of today's episode, I wanted to mention that you were, in fact, a friend of the late Michael Collins Piper. Would you mind telling some of our audience, perhaps some of the younger listeners, just a little bit about Michael and why they should be aware of his work?
He was, now I don't want to cry, but Michael and I were very close. We shared beliefs regarding Sandy Hook. Unfortunately, after over three decades, with a particular entity, he was dismissed, and he had given his life to this publication and to this entity. He was dismissed, and one of the reasons was the issue of Sandy Hook. And Mike wrote fabulous books. I have all of his books, all of them signed. He had all of my books, all of them signed, and we were just very close, and I miss him a lot.
So what do you think the reason that his work on Sandy Hook led to his dismissal?
Because he told his employer, this is going to bring you a lot of trouble, but the biggest issue was that they had a donor who said, and this donor contributed a lot of money, and basically said, you either get rid of Mike Piper or I'm not going to donate any more money. And we're talking major donations. And so Mike, and they did it at a time that he was incredibly sick. He was diabetic. He had neuropathy. He was in a great deal of pain. He did not receive any funds to help him. He lost his health care benefits, and he was just pretty much just discarded, and I just felt terrible. And he moved west, and within a very short period of time, he passed away due to his diabetes. He had what is called dead in bed syndrome, and we had cats. We shared our pictures of our cats, and his cat's name was Donald, and he talked about him on his program a lot, and I really miss Mike.
Well, thank you for sharing that. I personally have learned a lot from reading his works. He's a brilliant writer, and I think that people should go back and revisit what he wrote, because I think a lot of it is pertinent today.
It is.
So with that being said, you and Michael shared a similar position on the events of Sandy Hook. Would you give an introduction to that position and why it is that this might have caused some trouble?
We both believe, and there's certainly evidence to sustain our beliefs, that this event did happen, and happened as reported. Yet within 24 hours, in fact, maybe within 12 hours, there were people on the internet who were saying, "Oh, it's a hoax! It's a hoax!" And people typically remember the first things that they hear about an event. And it took a year for the authorities, federal and state, to go through all of the records. And all of these records, photos, I'm talking thousands and thousands of pages of transcripts, of photos, audio clips. It's all available, but people don't really do a lot of research. They prefer to join with, they prefer to follow, key opinion leaders. And, it's a lot less work. They just go along with whatever the consensus is without actually doing any research of their own. And there's really two kinds of research, when you're doing research. And it's really interesting to say that, some of the best research, or some of the most, some of the research that people need to do is in government records. And people say, "Oh, you can't trust the government. Oh, no, no, everything that they put out is a lie." But that's not true. If you look at the government records, for instance, in 1916, when they say that they passed the tax about the income tax, and they said, "Oh, everybody was gone. They were all gone, and they didn't have a quorum." But if you look at the actual records, you will find that they did have a quorum, and both the Senate and the House voted on this. So there's a lot of speculation, but you really have to look at the records. And essentially, there are two kinds of sources. They're primary or original, and secondary or compiled. Now, your primary sources are records that were created at the time of the event, or shortly thereafter by someone who has personal knowledge of the event. Now, this might be a birth or death certificate. Now, I've been doing research for a number of years, a different type of research. I did family history research. So I'm very familiar with working with government records, court records, all kinds of records. I've spent thousands of hours at the National Archives, both in Washington D.C., in Chicago. When the 1900 census came out, I went to Washington State and looked at those records, because that's where they were available, Seattle. And that was the closest, where I was living at the time, that was the closest facility. And so I've been doing primary research for decades. I'm not going to tell you how long, but it's been decades. Now, a primary source, for instance, if you were to use a death certificate, it would be a verification of death. And even if it contains the date of birth, that's not the primary source for the birth. It is the primary source for the death. So you have to use primary sources. For instance, a marriage record is the primary source for a marriage. And family historians and other researchers should always use primary sources when available. And for this event, you use government records because that is what is available. Those are the records that were created at the time of the event. And, but the government relies on the fact that most people are not going to do this. Most people want immediate answers for anything that happens. They want to know, especially when you're talking 20 little children, first graders, they want to know what in heaven's name happened to these precious little children. They don't want to wait until the official records come out. And they said, oh, gosh, the official records, it took a year. Well, when Columbine happened, it took about the same amount of time. Now, I mentioned primary sources, the two kinds of sources. They're primary or original and secondary or compiled. Secondary sources are typically compiled sources that are sometimes based on memory, speculation, or circumstantial evidence. And every researcher should cite their sources so that others might verify them by viewing the same information. And without verifiable sources, people may regard the information as hearsay or merely an opinion, which, like a smile, everybody possesses. So, right now, what you have, or what came out immediately after December 14th, 2012, was a lot of speculation. And you just have to ask, why would somebody come out within 12 hours or 24 hours and say that it was all a hoax? They are foolish to commit to such a statement. And yet it caught hold, and by the time the report came out a year later, there were many people who believed that, oh my gosh, it was a hoax. And the belief was so well set, and so well believed that it was difficult for those of us who were actually researchers to convince others that yes, this did happen. It happened, and it's a terrible thing that it happened. So that's kind of my background and my belief in sources. And all of my books, I cite my sources. And a lot of people, there were people who were producing YouTube videos about Sandy Hook. And YouTube videos are dangerous because you don't know who's putting that stuff out. You don't know who's created it. You don't know, whether it's a government agent. You don't know who it is. An Idaho potato peeler? Okay, well, that's just a name I threw up throughout. So maybe he produces a YouTube video, about Sandy Hook. Okay, where are your sources? So that we can verify what you're saying is true. But people don't do that. People have been programmed via television, and people watch television. People have been programmed to look at YouTube videos as the truth. You cannot do that. You need to have sources. You need to be able to look at the same source that the writer looked at and verify whether something is true or not. So I'm not a big YouTube viewer. I will look at YouTubes by people that whose books I have read. A person has to have a certain amount of legitimacy before I would accept what they would be talking about on a YouTube video. I'm a reader. I've been a reader for all my life. I have this huge library. It's really big. It's a lot of reference. Mike had a big library too. We both were crazy about books, and that was our source, our sources.
As some people may think it's, some of our listeners may find it strange to hear that Mike would be dismissed for affirming the fact that people were murdered that day in December. Could you explain why that would be the case?
I was wondering that as well.
Because he would not let go of the fact that Sandy Hook happened, and there were other people in the organization who wanted to promote it as a hoax. And so it was, like I said, it was the money issue.
And why would the money be on promoting it as a hoax? What's the incentive?
Well, if you have somebody that, say, is giving $20,000 every 3 or 4 months to an organization that is struggling to stay afloat, and they say, well, okay, I will continue to donate, but you have to get rid of Mike Piper.
Yes, but why would what was their incentive, right, the individuals donating the money to see it promoted as a hoax?
I have no idea.
You do not know? Okay. Fair enough.
I'm sure that there are some people that want to be right, and they use their money to influence others to accept their position on a particular thing. And
was this the only issue you think this donor was concerned about with Piper, or were there past issues that may have influenced this kind of final
straw? There were probably some personality issues.
Yeah, usually.
And Mike was, he said what he thought. And he didn't hold back. He spoke the truth. He said what he thought. And they treated him, I feel, very poorly. First they cut his salary in half, which is, and took the key away from him to the office, trying to get him to leave on his own. Mike was very dedicated. He went to law school. He was in law school for about a year. And then he went to work for this organization and had been with them all of his life. He was like you and I, you and me. We are obsessive about finding the truth, and we feel an obligation after we have discovered the truth to share it with others. And I believe that's a moral obligation that we all should share. Even if it goes against what a lot of other people, feel as a different, have a different viewpoint. The truth is the truth, period.
Deanna, do you suspect that there was some kind of state-sponsored disinformation campaign being run?
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely.
Well, why didn't you go into your suspicions of that a little bit?
All righty. If you take a look, if you visit the radio schedule page, and you can do that by visiting spingola.com, and on the left, you will see a button that says radio schedule.
And we'll put all the detailed links to this in the actual show, but that's where you could kind of find everything.
Right. And I usually, at the beginning of my program, I whip through this and I only say it one time, but I notice that real professional people, real professional radio people say things several times. And I figure, you know, you say things once, people ought to get it, but they don't get it.
The good thing about podcasts is you can have the playback option. With radio, yeah. You don't. So that is absolutely true when you're on radio. You don't have the rewind ability.
Exactly.
And you have people tuning in at different parts of the program. So that's another reason that they do it.
So if you visit Spingola.com, click on radio, the radio schedule button on the left-hand side, and then select January for January 2019, I have a lot of links for this particular podcast. And one of the links that I have, which I believe is very, very interesting, is the GDP. That's the gross domestic product. And I have a link that shows the statistics. And if you expand the statistics, you will find that in 1960, that 5% of the gross domestic product for healthcare was 5%. Now keep in mind that the United States is a corporation. It is not a country. And the 535 people who stand to gain from their decisions, make those decisions based on what the lobbyists put in their pocket into the pockets of the 535 people. And the pharmaceutical industry has more lobbyists and spends more money paying off politicians than any other entity, any other business. And the U.S. government is also the biggest consumer of pharmaceutical products. So you will find that in 1960, only 5% of the gross domestic product was spent on healthcare. But if you scroll up, you will find that in 2018, that 18.2% of the gross domestic product is 18.2%. Now, that's a lot of money. That is a great deal of money. And when you keep in mind that the politicians make the decisions and that the U.S. government is the biggest consumer of big pharma, then there is that is a very good reason to want to have people believe that Sandy Hook was a hoax. Because if it's a hoax, then people would just say, oh gosh, you're just trying to grab our guns. And that was one of the claims that were made. Oh, they're just doing this hoax because they want to take our guns. Well, that was 2012. Now we have another president. And Trump is a major supporter of the NRA. He spoke at the at that organization, National Rifle Association, and you are still having these mass shootings. So you have to say, well, gosh, if we're still having these mass shootings, and it's kind of there haven't been any where children were involved since then. Most of them have been with adults, and people don't get as upset when adults get shot. It's unfortunate. But so there you have a really big reason why the government would want to say, oh yes, it was a hoax. Otherwise people would say, well, what caused this? We better look and find out what was going on with AL, Adam Lanza. Don't like to say his name out loud. I don't think he deserves it. And one of the things that I would like to say regarding my book, when I was writing the book, I said I included Nancy Lanza, who was one of the victims of her son. And I said, Nancy Lanza, murdered by her son, as much of a victim of the mental health system as the others slaughtered on that dreadful day. Well, I would like to append or put in a caveat here, because Nancy Lanza knew that her son had severe mental problems for years and recognized his unpredictability. She was totally neglectful and irresponsible in that she not only allowed her son access to guns, but actually bought guns for him. Whether she was attempting to assuage him or what, whether she's a people pleaser or whatever, no individual who has ever been treated for mental issues should have access to a gun. Now, I know in Illinois, and I'm sure it's elsewhere in the country, anyone who owns a gun has to have a FOID card, a firearms owner ID. I have one. My husband had one. And so you have to have this card. But the minute that you have had any kind of mental health treatment or been treated for a mental issue, the state immediately, they keep a record of all the FOID card owners. The state immediately suspends that card and wants to make certain that the person who has been treated for a mental illness does not have access to a gun. That should have happened. Nancy Lanza was incredibly irresponsible, and she should have been more responsible, and maybe those children and those six adults would not have perished. I'm sorry. When I talk about these children, I do get emotional. On that website, Screening Sandy Hook, the website. I have a website where I have done kind of a little life story of the children. I have pictures from when many of them were babies, and I have pictures of their funerals. Many of them had open caskets. Many of them had lines of people waiting to get in. And I got very emotionally involved in this because of my belief and because of my research. I went through for quite a long time. After it happened, December 14th, 2012, I started looking at some of the dogma that people were talking about. I started looking at some of the claims, and there were holes in all these claims. It was just a bunch of nonsense, a bunch of garbage, a lack of research, just phony claims. And so I started research January 2013. And I published my book, Screening Sandy Hook, Causes and Consequences, in 2015. I researched for 3 years. I looked at all of the research, all of the paperwork, all of the pictures, everything that the government put out. I looked at the all of the committees, which I have indicated in my book. I tell in my book what I was looking at, and the cover up. There was definitely a cover up. It was a cover up. They would never release his AL's medical records because they said, because the assistant excuse me, the individual who worked for Health and Human Services said, let me just bring this up, said that if they released his records, that too many people would stop taking their medications.
Let me pause there for a moment, Deanna. What specific, are you aware specifically of what pharmaceuticals he was taking?
I have a list in front of me, if you'd prefer me to do it, unless you have it ready, Deanna.
They've never been really revealed, except we do know that he was on Ritalin. When Al was born, he was delivered C-section. And when you are delivered C-section, they cut the cord immediately, and one-third of the cord blood that should go to the infant's brain does not get to the brain. So first off, a C-section baby does not get all the blood that he is entitled to because they cut the cord, and then they save this blood. They sell it. He did not speak for 3 years. He was a headbanger. There were so many other things. And you will also find that the more programmed, the more affluent that parents are, the more they are apt to take and accept everything that their pediatrician suggests that they take. All of the vaccines, all of that. And so that is probably what they did. He probably was fully vaccinated.
From your book, you have Dr. Fox prescribing various medications to him. Is that something you're able to obtain?
Dr. Fox, there's an example of what he prescribed to another individual. Hang on, let me just bring this up in my book. Paul J. Fox, who left town. He left town. And he likely prescribed one or more SSRI drugs for Adam. And, but likely does not, it doesn't say specifically that he did. But we know what drugs he prescribed for other children who were diagnosed with the exact same thing that AL was diagnosed with. And Dr. Fox diagnosed him, diagnosed him with Asperger's syndrome. And he was under his care from January 1998 to March 1999. And,
Let me read a couple of them if you'd like me to, cause I have it right here. So, and this, from what I'm hearing from you now, is likely because there were other patients that had sort of similar conditions, but because these records were not released, we don't know this for certain, but this is sort of a hypothetical based on some sort of, inference. So Adam Lanza potentially was diagnosed with autoimmune diseases, anorexia, anxiety, attention deficit disorder, attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, autism, depression, hyperacusis, immune suppression, learning disabilities, obsessive compulsive disorder, panic attacks, phobias, photophobia, sensitivity to light, shyness, social segregation, isolation, suicidal thoughts. The prescriptions then were likely to be Prozac, antidepressants, SSRIs, for ADHD, Ritalin, and there was another schedule that you found, from another patient that may have been receiving, like Adam, Celexa, Neurotonin, I may be mispronouncing that, Buspar, and, Remeron. I don't know what all those do, but they sound very complicated. And given the list that you've described here, I don't know how you solve that with a bunch of chemicals. Just that's my personal opinion, but that is a long list. That is a very long
it
list.
It is. Now, Dr. Fox left town. He left the country. He left the country after this, after the event. And then he said, oh, his records weren't available. And it's just very fishy. And the photosensitivity that you mentioned, he developed this when he was about 10. He used to play outside all the time. And then he developed this photosensitivity, which is something that is that Prozac creates, and something that a singer, I can't remember his name, Charles, his real name was Charles, and he developed the same sensitivity, and he actually committed suicide because of this, and he was, let's see. I actually have a, I watched his video, but he committed suicide, within just a very short period of time, within a week after taking Prozac, and complained about the photosensitivity. And photosensitivity is that, you can't stand bright lights. And Adam, who used to be outside all the time, kind of changed his activities, so that he wasn't out climbing trees. He was doing other things in the house. He didn't. And the other thing is that he put black plastic over all of his windows to prevent light from coming into his bedroom because of this photosensitivity.
Yeah, allegedly he was obsessed with shootings, and he was compiling lists of how many people were killed in Excel. He would make these spreadsheets, and he sort of idolized the recent, at that time, shooting by Breivik in Norway.
Right.
According to your book.
Right.
So I guess that's what one of the activities he found himself doing. Apparently he was editing Wikipedia entries.
Yes.
Also from what you mentioned.
Yes.
About these shootings. Nick, you were saying though.
Well, my question is about the nature of the potential state disinformation campaign and to what extent the speculation as to whether or not this was a hoax was something that was created by system media narrative, or, you know, egged along, you may say, by the manner in which they reported these events. Because I do remember when this took place, there were many strange things that the media was it was a very bizarre media circus. I think people will remember, for example, the strange behavior of the mortician, who was just very creepy.
Okay, he was the medical examiner.
Medical examiner, I see.
Okay. He had just when he appeared before the group of people, and you're never shown how many people he is talking to, but he appeared, he had been up all night, had done several of the autopsies, and he was a very unique individual, and we can attribute, or people did attribute to him, that he wasn't acting appropriately. Well, what's the appropriate activity for a person who has just done autopsies on several children? What is there a list somewhere that we don't know about that says what's appropriate behavior and what isn't? And so when people are trying to say that something is a hoax, they are going to...
What did he do exactly? I didn't see this, and, you know, I'm just imagining ourselves in a courtroom here, regardless of sort of opinion.
Oh,
what were the actual actions
smiled.
That he did? He smiled about it. Okay.
They said he smiled. Maybe, okay, nobody said anything about, who's the gentleman whose wife killed.
Was that Robbie
children.
Parker?
No.
Yeah, I want to talk about him.
That's
though,
another situation that we'll talk about. But there was a gentleman whose wife killed five. Well, let's talk about the sensitivity first before we move on to something else. You asked me about the sensitivity, and I was going to tell you about Del Shannon. Now, he was an artist. He was a songwriter, a singer, and he killed himself 5 days after he went on Prozac. And he had some of the very same issues that Adam Lanza suffered. He suffered akathisia, agitation, and photosensitivity, and profuse sweating. And Del Shannon killed himself. And his wife testified before this group and who were investigating, and they didn't accept her testimony, or any of the other 60 people who were testifying in this Prozac court. And anyway, he killed himself. And so anyway. Now you talked about the what was that other question you asked?
He was asking about the medical examiner.
Okay, the medical examiner.
No, I was not hung up specifically on the medical examiner. I'm just curious to – I'm recollecting things that stood out as far as things that people were pointing to that were strange. One of my main questions, and you can confirm this or correct the record here, Deanna, is the extent to which the standard operating procedure, emergency operating procedures, were followed correctly or not.
Mm-hmm.
I do remember that there was an issue with the police being the ones to pronounce the children dead. Well, please go on. Go ahead.
Okay. You had first responders, and those first responders included nurses and people who could pronounce death. And I have on the page that I recommended that people visit, I have that would be Deanna Screening Sandy Hook Research. There's what is called the toe tags. And you have four colors on a toe tag. And black means that the individual was dead. And so if people could not pronounce death, if the first responders, including the RNs that were among those first responders, if they could not pronounce death, then why would you have black on the toe tags? You wouldn't.
I see. And so the presence of registered nurses was enough to proclaim
yes.
Death time. I see.
Yes. You don't wait until you get somebody to the hospital to say, oh, yes, this person is dead. You have to do it right on the spot. You have to go in.
It's indispensable for triage reasons. You know, you can focus on people who are alive.
Absolutely. You have to, when you're doing triage, that is what you have to do, is you have to figure out who's dead, who needs, there's red, green, and blue. You have to figure out who needs immediate care, who needs care, who is dead and beyond needing that care, and that's how it works. In every situation. And so when people say, oh, they didn't follow procedure, that is just not true.
So the main issue that you think the system would be invested in is, of course, the pharmaceutical issue. Were there any instances that you're aware of of the issue being brought up in any kind of mainstream media context and how that was dealt with, if it was dealt with?
Hang on. The triage colors is green, yellow, red, and black. Okay, I just wanted to clarify. I don't want anybody saying, oh, she said blue, she's lying. But it's green, yellow, red, and black. Okay, your question about...
I didn't quite understand, Nick. So you're asking if there was mainstream media coverage or what in particular?
No, I'm asking whether or not the pharmaceutical issue ever addressed in a public media forum of any kind or if, because it seems that that would be, Deanna's position, which makes sense to me, was that that's what they're most concerned about because there's a lot of money riding on this and also a lot of, I mean, the system has, in addition to money, they also have an investment in behavioral modification of subjects as well.
Seems like the best thing to do would be to not talk about it, though, because then people...
Well, yeah, that's what I would expect, but I'm curious if, since Jana's researched this extensively, whether this issue has come up.
Okay.
Not really. They did have they got together for a committee meeting, in which they pretty much covered the thing up
whom are you, referring to here?
Okay. After the fact, the Connecticut, decided to have this meeting.
Okay, Connecticut.
And they decided in their committee that, and this would be in, let's see, this would be under damage control, part 5 of my book. And what they did was they got together and had a meeting, and they decided that, gosh, we really do need to have more healthcare management so that this doesn't happen again. So instead of saying, well, gosh, it might be because he was on all these medications and he had all of these issues from early on, one would think that they would address that, but instead they viewed it as, oh, well, we just need to have more mental health care and then this wouldn't happen.
And if 18.2% wasn't enough, I mean, why not increase that even more? What does that mean?
And this was the Sandy Hook Advisory Commission is who made this decision.
Thank you. Yes. I'm just asking more generally, and I'm not a medical expert. I just, when I see the vast sums of money being poured into the stuff and just a never ending increase, it would seem, I really question fundamentally what adding more layers of bureaucracy is going to fundamentally do. It seems there's a more of a root issue with our society, but how do you solve
it?
It's even harder, obviously. It just seems easier just to write a prescription, give the guy a drug and make him go away. It seems to be the pattern.
So what?
Well, go ahead.
Well, what exactly is the agreed media explanation as to why this happened or as to what motivated this kid? What are we to believe is the reason for this?
Okay, what they covered up, what they decided, it was called, and this is under the chapter, the Stacked Sandy Hook Advisory Commission. And, you know, every time that there's a major crime, they always have a commission, whether it's the Warren Commission or whether it's the Roberts Commission or the 9/11 Commission, they always have a commission that gives the public the reason for something that happened. So on January 3rd of 2013, Connecticut Governor Daniel P. Malloy established the Sandy Hook Advisory Commission, CHAC, S-H-A-C, an expert panel comprised of those he viewed as capable of reviewing the current policy and then to make recommendations in three areas of public safety. paying particular attention to school safety, mental health, and gun violence prevention. So, he probably felt that the mental health of the shooter was a factor, and Malloy appointed Scott Jackson, who was elected as the mayor of Hamden in 2009, as the facilitator for the 16-member committee. And the people that were on this committee, well, they were just very interesting people. They were pretty much all pro medication. And Jackson had worked for Senator Joseph Lieberman, and then he, it just, let me just read off who was on this committee. They all pretty much decided that, gosh, we just need more help for these children. We need more screening. So these people, the people on the committee, they were appointed on January 8th, 2013. Less than a month after it occurred. He appointed Dr. Ezra Griffith, who is a professor emeritus of the and senior research scientist in psychiatry at Yale University. Others from the Yale Child Study Center offered testimony. They included Dr. Adrian Bentman, who was the director of the Adult Psychiatry Residency Program, Hartford Hospital Institute of Living, Ron Shavinsky, who is a teacher, Robert Ducibella, Terry Edelstein, a member of Three Branch Home Team, Kathleen Flaherty, staff attorney for the National Alliance on Mental Illness, NAMI. NAMI is a group of people which is paid for by the pharmaceutical industry. And Flaherty, Kathleen Flaherty, is a state trainer, presenter, and facilitator for NAMI in Connecticut. And the drug industry funds NAMI. Okay? The drug industry has given over $41 million to NAMI, just in recent years. Well, if you add it all up, it's a bunch of money. And so all the people on this committee, do you think they're going to say, well, gosh, you know, we just think that people need more mental health care and more medical intervention.
I wanted to just point out, because when this happened, I'll be honest, I didn't delve into it with the degree that Deanna did, and that's why I appreciate you so much coming on and sharing the findings from your book, which is extremely detailed. I mean, I remember actually looking at certain references, and it was in the thousands. She lists everything out. So again, just wanted to reiterate that she's done excellent work. I just have some general kind of intuitive questions, though. So
sure.
When I re-looked at this, Adam was 20 when he did this, if I'm not mistaken. I always thought he was like a student at the school, sort of like Columbine, but that's not the case, if I'm reading this right. And so if there's sort of these sort of mental health people are recommending that we screen children for this issue, it's not really a child who did this. It was an adult, and he obviously had issues. But what are you going to do short of putting him in a prison cell for 20 years of his life? I mean, it's not going to prevent anything. I don't know how you stop this sort of thing, you know, in 100% terms. It seems like bad things happen. I'm struggling to really see a real solution here short of a radical change in our society. Because, and I'll bring this other point up, there are other societies that have firearms given out to people. Switzerland is obviously the most commonly cited. They don't have these shootings. Canada also, you know, has firearms for people. They do have to get a license for it, but if I'm not mistaken, it's a little bit more rigorous than here, obviously, but they have them, but they don't have this type of violence. I think there's a difference in our society, and that's just, again, my intuition here, but I just wanted to make those couple points.
They don't use the psychiatric drugs that Americans do.
So that's my other question. Do you think these drugs are actually causing them, or causing these problems, or do you think it's symptomatic of troubled people who then get, you know, who would do it anyway, but are given these drugs to kind of quell some of these issues? Because there's two separate things.
It doesn't quell any issue. Now, I'm not saying that all psychiatric drugs are bad, but when you put children on Ritalin early on, and then you put them on something like Prozac. Now, Prozac.
So those are two different. So Ritalin is for ADHD, like they can't pay attention
to
school.
That's what they say.
And then Prozac is for depression,
okay, but
I'm not mistaken. Just asking.
Boys are typically put on Ritalin before girls are, because boys are more rambunctious,
right.
And you get a bunch of children in a classroom. Now, keep in mind that the federal government pays schools for the number of disabled children that they have. So it stands to reason, or it is very profitable for the schools to designate or to target children who may have a problem, who are a little bit fidgety. They don't want to sit. They would rather be out running around. So it is profitable. Financially profitable for a school to have as many disabled, quote unquote, children as they can, because then they get more money from the federal government. And that is a result of having a Department of Education associated with the federal government.
I have some other questions, unless Nick, you wanted to go forward with the current topics.
Well, I have a question that's a little bit out of left field, so I'll hold on to it for a moment here.
Sure. I was going to ask you about vaccines, because the first part of your book actually focuses on sort of vaccinations and actually kind of the beginnings of the whole sort of pharmaceutical industry in the United States. One of your sort of arguments is that the industry, and you're not alone in this, many other people have mentioned this, that the Rockefellers were a big proponent of using chemicals to basically treat illness, which makes
sense. Petrochemicals specifically.
Exactly, because they're derived from, you know, their principal product. So you go through that. There's $1 million grants given out to various universities for funding these types of initiatives. But then you talk about vaccines, and you even include a quote from Jonas Salk, which I'll read the passage you have in your book. In 1977, Dr. Jonas Salk admitted, so backing up, he was the one who invented the polio vaccine, or discovered it. So in 1977, Dr. Jonas Salk admitted to a Senate committee that mass polio vaccinations caused most of the polio cases throughout the country since 1961. He said, live virus vaccines against influenza or polio myotitis may in each instance produce the disease it is intended to prevent. The live virus against measles and mumps may produce such side effects as encephalitis, brain damage. That's a pretty damning statement for sort of the guy who created the polio vaccine. So what's going on with vaccines? I mean, and there's a huge number of vaccinations that are done every year to children. And also you mentioned the military, which is it's almost like they're guinea pigs, if you want to
they
be
are.
Cynical about it. But, yeah, they're given probably the largest
they are guinea pigs.
Schedule of anybody. Yeah. And it's too long to read, but it was in like the over 50 vaccinations I think they're given. So please go ahead.
That's why I say that they use the military. They use, well, for instance, if you're in a nursing home, many residents of nursing homes are over-medicated because they're a captive audience. When you're talking about vaccines, now they want to give your pets. Pets are another group of animals, another group that they can sell their products to.
Yeah.
Now,
Well, people don't have children anymore, so you gotta, open the market up.
Report. Okay, the very, very first form of healing a person was that you used your mind to heal your body. Then came acupuncture and herbs. And then you had naturopathy, and you had homeopathy, and you had chiropractic. And then in 1910, the Flexner Report came out, and this was funded by Carnegie and Rockefeller. And they decided, supported by the Flexner Report, which they prayed for, they decided that all of these other methods of healing and taking care of yourself were obsolete, and that the only medicines that should be used would be chemicals, surgery, burning, cutting, that kind of thing. And then they also established the American Medical Association, which is a physicians' labor union that will protect physicians. And they did that in 1847. And so then you have the Flexner Report. And, of course, they had a lot of money to spend on politicians, and so the politicians supported this report. And pretty soon, all of these other methods of healing were discarded. And now when people talk about traditional medicine, they're not talking about traditional medicine. They're talking about allopathic medicine, which is the only medicine that is currently really in vogue.
Well, on this topic, there is a term used by a favorite writer of the show, myself especially, Nicholas Nassim Taleb, who would describe this as iatrogenics.
Right.
And in Greek, as I understand it, I believe iatros means from the healer, brought on by the healer.
Right.
So iatrogenic medicine would be forms of treatments that end up causing harm.
There are more people killed by medical practice than by gunshot. You're more apt to be killed by your doctor than you are by being shot.
Well, and if it's true that it's some kind of iatrogenics that are causing this behavior that leads to mass violence against children, then you could even lump that in with it.
Absolutely. And the person I was trying to think of was Andrea Yates. She drowned her 5 children in a bathtub on June 20th of 2001. And when he was giving, the husband was giving, talking about it in the front of his home, just within hours after this occurred, he smiled. It doesn't mean that he was happy. It was Russell Yates. And nobody accused him of acting inappropriately when he smiled intermittently while giving a press conference on his front lawn just hours after his wife drowned the couple's 5 children in the bathtub. And she had been on some psychiatric drugs. Mm-hmm. And yet, when... You know, you mentioned the medical examiner that he grimaced. I don't think it was a smile. It was a grimace. But there's all kinds of, people saying, oh gosh, Parker, he was laughing when he came out of the church. He had just been in a meeting, at his church, and he was there probably and this is Robbie Parker that we're talking about. And this was on the day after the event on December 15th. And CNN, and I talk a lot about CNN, filmed him in an 18-minute press conference just outside the doors that his family attended in Newtown. And he had just met with fellow church members. And the very next day, somebody, a YouTuber, uploaded just 27 seconds of the CNN video. And then Alex Jones published the very brief video excerpt within hours, well, the next day on the 17th. And so why didn't they show the entire 18 minutes? If you look at the entire 18 minutes, you see how he felt about his child. And it's very deceptive. And who took that 27 seconds out of 18 minutes? And then and made a decision about his behavior. That's just speculation. It's damnable research. Okay? It's terrible.
Well, I'll admit I was caught off guard by the way he was behaving. I can maybe make the case as to why that was excerpted the way it was. To me, it was showing the contrast between the on-air and off-air personas, and that is what was the most unusual behavior of him. I don't really know much about him, but if I can sort of make, you know, the point of view that I had, I'm not claiming it's definitive on who this man is, but what I remember from seeing that is that he was talking to some people off air, and I mean, he's smiling, he's in a joking manner, he's laughing, and then he is walking up to the podium to speak, and to me, it seemed like a 180 change in his personality, where he was trying to, you could argue, he was trying to get into character, or he was at least embarrassed that he was laughing and he didn't want to show that on air, and he was maybe reminding himself. I don't know. I'm speculating here, but it is odd. I will say that.
But 27 seconds out of this, 27 seconds is all they showed. And they showed him laughing and allegedly hyperventilating and suggested he was an actor attempting to get into character. I don't view him that way at all. I view him as emotionally preparing to talk about an incredibly painful situation. How do you approach a conference, a press conference, and talk about your child that's just been murdered? You're going to have to gather your courage. And they totally misrepresented what he was doing. And the fact that they didn't show the entire 18 minutes is indicative that they just wanted you to see what they wanted to show you and then put their interpretation to it. That's dishonest and deceptive. Whoever did this is dishonest and deceptive.
So, Deanna, if you're ready for my sort of out of left field question, you remember when this took place, it was an influence of a certain types of talking points that centered around a narrative that went something like, let go of hate. And there was an individual I'm curious if you're familiar with named Dr. John Woodall. Are you familiar with this man?
Oh, yes, Woodall. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so this was something I found to be very interesting because he's involved with the Baha'i organization, which mm-hmm. is effectively a New World Order globalist cult.
Sure.
Is effectively what it is. I mean, they favor a world superstate, a world legislature, a world parliament. Or, I mean, it's something right out of like mm-hmm. old John Birch Society if it was, you know, their Satan was made into a god. Mm-hmm. But he was involved personally with his apparent specialty is shaping attitudes and reactions to trauma and crisis, and he was involved with, you would maybe say, counseling children in the aftermath of 9/11. He was also
or after. After 9/11,
both 9/11 and Sandy Hook, yes, as well as Hurricane Katrina too. There was a there's an organization that's tied in with the Baha'i, and I believe Woodall was instrumental in the organization on some level. It's called the Unity Project. But I remember he gave a speech not too long after Sandy Hook, and the speech was titled something to the effect of "From New Town to New World." And it seems to me that there are basically government-affiliated psychiatrists who are interested in how to use trauma, how to use public violence and public trauma events to push a particular narrative. And in this case, it's a very pernicious and in-your-face form of globalism.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, I just was curious your thoughts on this, because this is something that stood out.
Well, when you have anybody that has a particular agenda, they're going to use any event that occurs in order to promote that agenda.
Yes, yes. Yeah, crisis breeds opportunity for
Leviathan. Sure.
We do know this. Yeah, I found that to be interesting, because I think that you see a lot of this type of angling in the aftermath of shootings, and often the ones that involve children. It's very common, because that's obviously much more traumatic. I mean, it's just the way it is. I mean, when children are killed, this is a far more traumatic thing than, adults.
Sure.
That's how it works. And I see a similar – I saw a little bit. I wasn't following it too closely, but there was the recent shootings in Florida. And I saw a little bit of the same thing. They're rolling out their PR people. But it seems that they're kind of getting better at this. That this is something that they've been practicing, and they're refining it into a consistency as to how it is, how you run with narratives after trauma. And what did you see as far as maybe you'd say social conditioning, social engineering, behavioral conditioning that is common to events like Sandy Hook and other shootings, particularly those involving children? Do you see common threads with how it is that the public, that the system is invested in how the public responds, how they behave, how they feel, and what exactly they want people to feel and how they want them to respond?
Well, all of the churches in Sandy Hook and in the vicinity were probably offering counseling, and so this was an opportunity for anybody that could offer anything with their own agenda. So I don't think he was speaking for the town. I think he was speaking who knows who he was speaking for. But I know that he was there and saying whatever it was he was saying.
Is it true that the town is itself something of a commuter town for people who work for the state?
It is a town where people, it's very close to New York City. It is a bedroom community.
Yeah, right. That's what they say, bedroom community. Okay.
And there were, 28,000 people that lived there. It's part, Sandy Hook was part of Newtown. And, so.
And what was, Adam Lanza's relationship to the school? Was there any reason why he would have ended up there as opposed to somewhere else?
I think he went there as a child. Other than that, I don't know why.
He went there as a child. And certainly, a group of cowering 6- and 7-year-olds was a much better target than a group of teenagers. And people like A.L. Certainly was in it to kill as many people as he possibly could. And he had made a trip the day before to the school, probably determining how long it would take to get there. So it was planned. And This was a person who wanted as many kills as he could get.
I suppose maybe we should talk a bit about Alex Jones, you mentioned earlier. He had also an individual on his program who was, I guess, making the rounds, so to speak. His name was, I believe, Halbig. Is that? Yeah, I see you have something to say about this man, so please go ahead, Jenna.
I have written so many articles on Halbig, who he was, what he did. He was, he said that he was a former Florida state trooper. However, he was, when you become a state trooper, you go through basic education and schooling. He didn't even make it past the stage where he was actually a state trooper. He didn't make it. He was booted out. And as I said, I've written numerous articles about him. If one were to look at the my page where I talk about I interviewed him. I interviewed him, and it was really quite funny. I kind of lost my patience with him, which probably wasn't a good thing. And he called into my program and hung up. He was, he asked 16 questions, which were answered repeatedly and repeatedly. And I have links for my interview with him. And, there have been some people said that my interview of him was the most direct of anybody's. He was a rookie. As I said, he was a rookie, who did not make it as a state trooper. And I wrote an article about it called Florida State Trooper Rookie, Wolfgang Halbig. And I wrote this back in 2017. And I actually heard from somebody that was in police enforcement in Florida. And he stated that he was a trooper from 1974 to 1975, which means he didn't surpass the probationary period. So when he was saying that he was this state trooper, you have to look at the actual facts. No, he was never a state trooper. He tried to be a state trooper, but he didn't have what it took. And then he went on to say that he was, what else did he say? That he made the comment that he was a specialist in school safety and that he had certificates, and that he was an instructor. But the certificates that he had, were ones that you can get off the internet for taking a little 1 hour class. He said that he had a certificate from the Emergency Management Institute. And you can get that in 1 day. So his certificates were just from a 3 hour class online. How does that make you a school safety expert?
So if you allow me to clarify, Dana, for the listeners,
go ahead.
This was an individual who, as Dana was saying, made particular claims about his qualifications and was, as I said, making the rounds on programs like Alex Jones. If I'm not mistaken, Alex Jones' controversial position on the Sandy Hook came partly, I suppose, from this individual, or at least from having him on his program for an interview. And he was, of course, claiming, yes, that this was some kind of hoax and that nothing had happened here. And so I just wanted to clear that up because I highly doubt people remember the name of this guy unless
people loved him. And he also had this other Children's Safety Institute that he claimed that he is a nationally recognized school safety and security professional who has done extensive work in researching and developing the standards for safe schools. Within days after I had, he also claimed that he was a featured guest on Dateline NBC, Good Morning America, MSNBC, and all these other things. But there was no proof. Nobody could ever, I couldn't find anything about him being on any of these programs. And within days of my interviewing him, he took that website down. Mm-hmm. He also claims to have been a customs officer. Well, how can you be a customs officer because you also have to go through the very same probationary period as a customs officer as you would as a Florida State Trooper? And he makes all these claims. And he also said that he was an instructor in the U.S. Air Force. And to be an instructor, you have to first of all, a military occupational specialty, an MOS. And when you go in for a short term, which is what he did, you don't get to be one of these big instructors because those are saved for people who sign a contract for at least 6 years.
So I suppose he was also an Olympic athlete and a traveling magician as well.
Yes, I'm sure that that's part of this. And he also said, get this, and he posted, on July 24th, 2012, several months before, he was in another business. And on July 24th, 2012, he attempted to raise $100,000 in a comment that he made at the Take Part website. The comments were scrubbed after I mentioned them on March 4th, 2014. However, I did get a screenshot, and I also have the audio file. Anyway, what he said on that date, July 24th, 2012, he said, I need financial help in fighting for children that are harassed, threatened, intimidated, assaulted, racially, and now gender discriminated against. I'm trying to provide to parents technology for doing this. And he says, I need $100,000, and probably I could pay it back once the company is up and running. And then he gives his name and his phone number, and somebody answered. He said, if you're trying to pass yourself off as a businessman, you have failed, because if you had more than one day of school, you would know that $100,000, he wrote the numerical 100,000, and then he adds $1,000 after that. Makes no sense. And so I asked him about it on the program, and I asked him a lot of he was so mad at that program. It was pretty pathetic.
So I'm getting the impression, because this answers, I think, my next question, which is that this individual, do you suspect, was just basically a grifter for his own purposes rather than somebody who may be working with powers?
He was an opportunist.
Yeah, okay. That's the impression.
And he was a wannabe. And he was actually, when I asked him direct questions, he avoided direct questions. Oh, and he told me, this is really funny. I asked him where his office was. And of course I looked up the address and everything. And I said, so where's your office? And he told me where his office was. And it turned out to be the UPS, UPS store. And it turned out to be a box at the UPS store.
Yes. It's coming to my office. It's in the parking lot.
Yes. It's in my car.
It's me at Starbucks. I've had a few meetings at Starbucks with people like this.
Hey, Starbucks is my office, actually. Well, not Starbucks, but
it's the office for most people these days.
Yeah. Don't shop at Starbucks, folks. Yeah. But
And this other one, what's Hal Big hiding? I have done so many stories on Hal Big. He didn't even know his mother until he was 12. And,
let's not pour sand into this guy's grave. I think he's already underground at this point.
Okay.
I just wanted to make sure we get anything else you wanted to talk about in your book. I have a few general comments, but, I think, you know, you've done a good job presenting a lot of details that I think a lot of people probably have never even heard. And again, I want to thank you for doing all the research. Do you have anything you'd like to focus on, before we wrap up or anything?
Well, I have an idea. Yeah. So Deanna, maybe you could give some advice to people, who are maybe writers or independent journalists themselves. Just when a big event like this happens, how should they go about, researching it appropriately? And
that's a good question.
People should wait until the actual records. I know that people say, oh gosh, you can't do that, because the government lies. No, if you want to research anything, you look at the official reports. You're not going to get, 200 or 300 people who are policemen, state policemen, local policemen. You're not going to get all of these people to create reports and to create audio files and to create false statements. Thousands and thousands and thousands of pages of false statements. Plus photos of the home and photos of everything that they took. I'm talking 700-800 photos. How are you going to stage all of that because quite frankly, most of the people in the so-called alternative movement aren't going to look at all this stuff anyway. But the official reports are the official reports of this event. They are the primary records. But you will be discouraged from looking at those primary records because there are people in the so-called alternative movement that are there to prevent you, to discourage you from looking at the actual event and instead saying, oh, it's a hoax. Remember, it's 18.2% of the gross domestic product is for healthcare.
And what is the best way for an independent journalist to access firsthand sources?
Most people don't even know where to look.
Yes, so
that's why I was asking. What do you recommend?
Okay, so what you would do for this particular event,
or generally speaking as well, but please go ahead.
Okay, for any event, you visit Department of Emergency Services and Public Protection, and there's a page there, Sandy Hook Elementary School Shooting Reports, and there are hundreds of files, hundreds and hundreds of files, audio files, a lot of files. And you can download all of those files and look at them. So you look at the official records. If you wanted to know what happened, in any event, you look at the federal register, for things that happen in court.
Would you say that other primary source materials are not credible because they're not from the government? Let's say someone had like a cell phone recording of something that was actually there.
Okay, that would be a primary source.
Yeah.
Somebody that's actually there that recorded something, that's a primary source. He was there. She or he was there at the time. Yes, that's primary.
Yeah. And I would agree. I would not discard.
What would you say regarding making use of FOIA requests?
Oh, definitely. Absolutely. That's how a lot of things come about, how a lot of things are revealed.
I've never done this. Have you ever gone through that process, though, Deanna?
No.
I understand it's – I have not either, but I understand it's actually not very difficult.
It isn't difficult from what I understand.
Yeah. And what is available from that type of request? I know it was passed after some scandal some years ago, but –
I think it was passed under the Clinton administration.
Yeah, but you can't get classified information, right? And like, what is the scope that is available, I think, is...
Well, it depends on what the government decides to release.
Right.
For instance, the Kennedy, JFK files, some of them were just recently released, but most people are not going to spend hours and hours and hours at some facility looking at records.
No, this is only for people who are researchers or, you know, journalists these days, who knows what to expect. But, you know, people who are professionals or committed to this type of thing. But my other question to follow up to this is, for most people, as you point out, don't have the time or won't make the time. So where do they go to learn about these events? Because reading your book, I will admit, it was a lot of work. I mean, and it was not to say that you didn't do a good job, but that was, you know, something that I had to commit to. And even that, I wonder if people are able to digest that, you know, the most common people. So I think what you're noticing is that most people kind of defer to authority or defer to kind of personalities often.
Right.
In terms of understanding things. Is there a way to improve upon that?
Well, Adam, I get the impression from Deanna that she would say it's important that you just watch Alex Jones and believe what he says.
Okay. As I mentioned before, people have been programmed for decades to get their information from the TV. That's why they call it programming. They are programming. And you're going to get talking points. That's all you're going to get. If you want in-depth coverage, you have to open a book. You have to read. You have to spend time. People don't have the time. They have families that they have to take care of. They have children. They have two jobs. They don't have the time. And the other thing, too, is you don't want to be the lone student in a classroom that raises your hand and say, I disagree with that comment. I disagree with what everybody else in this, all the other students in this class are acquiescing to. People don't like to do that. You want to be part of the crowd. You want to be with the in group. You don't want to be the person that has a different opinion. You don't want to be the critical thinker and actually challenge what you're being told. It's just too easy to watch a 15-minute YouTube video and think that you know everything. Or 30 minutes for Alex Jones, or however long his programs are.
I think, to maybe just summarize that, I think just be very skeptical of anything that you see and hear, especially if you didn't actually see it, especially if it's through a screen or something like that, and includes anything we say. Please try to do your own research and critical thinking, because we are doing our best, but we are dealing with a very complicated world, and we by no means have omniscience. And I think that's a general sort of lesson for anybody who's trying to understand things, is be humble.
Mm-hmm. Well, as you said, my book is tough to go through. I tend to be a very redundant, and I tend to, but I'm not sorry. Like Risa say, I'm not sorry.
No, it's a good resource. And if people are committed to this, it is very valuable in that regard. So people can reference it. I mean, I quoted several things, you know, from my own, you know, research in other areas of what I'm interested in. So it's a valuable research, and you've done a good job. In terms of the propaganda war, it'll be a component of probably someone who's, you know, got a loudspeaker if we ever change our society the way it should change. But it's a lesson in sort of how information is managed and how the different approaches, whether they're right or wrong, went out. I think that's probably the biggest takeaway I get from this event, because I had a few comments about some of the other things you mentioned in the book, where they were talking about, obviously guns came up. We don't need to talk about that really, because I think that's been done elsewhere so many times, but homeschooling came up. So AL, as you say, was homeschooled. And I think whenever some extreme event happens like this, people will take a look at the pieces of it and tend to extrapolate onto their sort of pet project, whether it's pro-homeschools, anti-homeschools, pro-gun, anti-gun, pro-pharma, anti-pharma. I hope people don't just knee-jerk react to things like this. And it's also important to remember that this is a event in a very large country and a very large planet. And mm-hmm. so it is important, and it isn't, you know, obviously a tragedy in terms of whether you think it was real or not. I mean, it just had this massive impact on things. So you do need to take it seriously, but it is something that, people can get swept away in certain things. And so it's important to be statistical about this stuff and sort of be reasonable in terms of applying this to things that, you know, may not, you know, be responsible for it. And so homeschooling was one thing that I thought, and it didn't really, I didn't hear much about that in the press, but I would hate to hear people sort of say, well, we need to get rid of homeschooling now because Adam Lanza was homeschooled. And that's a ridiculous argument, you know.
He was for a short period of time. But for the most part, he was in school, from the first through the fifth grade. And his mother took him out for just a brief period of time when he began to have more serious difficulties.
Well, and maybe that was something to give different credit for. I mean, she may have known, you know, that this kid was dangerous.
Oh.
You know, I don't know.
He had problems from the day he was born.
Yeah.
So,
and what to say about parenting too? I mean, parenting is a tough job in any circumstance, but especially if you've got a child that's exhibiting that laundry list of symptoms that he was allegedly treated for. And, while I understand what you're saying about, you know, her decision to go take him shooting probably wasn't the best, it's hard when you got someone who's got this many, I know people who have, you know, mental, you know, issues. I wouldn't say they're bad people, but they've been diagnosed with certain things and I can see them struggling with it. And I can only imagine if someone with that many problems, is under the care of a sole single mother. That wasn't always the case. I think they divorced when he was 16 and he did this when he was 20, but, that's a lot of work for a parent. So I sympathize with anybody who has a trouble
His father attempted to be part of his life. And up to the age of 10, he was. And then he just started closing himself in. That was when he started putting the plastic up. He just wasn't the same person. And his father noted that. And I've talked about his father in the book. Before, he was just a weird little kid. And then it became much more serious.
Well, we will be providing a link to you do have it available in PDF, correct?
Oh, it's on Amazon.
I do, and I do have some available from me if people wanted to buy one from me.
Oh, you mean like a paperback?
Like a real book, yeah.
Ooh, a real book. Very good. Okay. I'm glad someone's still putting out real books.
Yes, a hard copy or a paperback.
Well, we will provide all the information and links to your work. People will see in the show description. And if there is not anything else you want to hit on, Deanna, I think this has been very productive, and I think people are interested to hear what you found about this. So thank you very much.
Well, thank you. Thank you for asking me to be on the program. I appreciate you and your work, and so thank you very much.